Thank you. Toda. If you could just move this way so I don't have to speak backwards. And my voice is bad. I'm jet-lagged horribly. I begged Mish not to invite me today, but she wouldn't do otherwise. Here's just a couple of introductory notes, and then we'll start. I have cards. I'll leave them here. If anybody wants to follow up with questions, I'm compulsive about answering emails, so you can send them or call. Also, there may be quite a few bibliographic references. If you call me and ask for the list, I'll send it to you. This is an introductory note unrelated to what's to come. Many years ago, I went to with Chaya to hear Yitzhak Perlman play Scarlatti at the Jerusalem Theater. It was a performance so moving that you could be moved to tears. You were moved to tears. It's a nearly godlike capacity that a human being could make sounds like that come off four strings. 4 hours before, there had been a horrific bombing in downtown Jerusalem and many people maimed and killed. And I said to Chaya, is he really going to stand there and play Scarlatti and make no reference? And he made reference. And so the elephant is in this room, and I want to address this for a second. Otherwise, you think Levi Lauer comes, and this is going on, and he talks about God and social justice. So I want to muddy the waters. These are the illusions we cannot live with and have a country in which we will be able to exist, which is why this threat is existential. It's not the knifings or being run over. That could happen. That's not existential. The threat is existential unless we don't give in to the following temptations. First, doing nothing is not an answer. Saying that this is a 100-year war and we will just outlast it is not an answer for my grandchildren, one of whom is currently serving in the Air Force. Secondly, it is not feasible to have an illusion that 4 million people will, if you stand on the left, suddenly learn to like you. They will not. Without making generalizations, because things are, of course, much more complex, it's not them and us. And on the right, it is an illusion to imagine that they will willingly accept your rule or disappear, that you have enough Egged buses to move them to Gaza or to the West Bank or to Jordan or pick wherever you want. Thirdly, saying I don't know what to do is also not an answer. For that, we didn't build a Jewish state. I'm only here 40 years, and so I feel a little nervous saying this. But I did not come here to say I don't know. I came here to take full responsibility for Jewish authority and power, and I don't know is not an answer. And finally, the answer, Hashem Yishmor, is worse than not an answer. Not only because Jewish history teaches us that crystal clear, but because the Rambam tells you that if you talk like that, you are put into the category of the fool. So if that sounds harsh, read the Rambam in the Moren. I wouldn't take Levi Lauer's word for it. The notion that somehow the God of Israel will intervene in human history to end intifadot is beyond the pale of feasible, acceptable belief. So is the Marxist contention that if things get bad enough, they can only get better, because they forgot that Stalin came to power. Okay, that's all unrelated. First, I want to thank Mish, Rav Hammer Kassoy. It's good to say that. It took the Jews a very long time to finally understand what they needed to do. For inviting me, your time is precious, and I'm grateful that you're willing to share some of it with me. I want to share with you some thoughts about the synthesis of emunah, trust, in what, by the way, is no small question, the synthesis of emunah and humanist activism, which is to ask, to make myself more vulnerable than I should, what is it that God really wants of me? Which is to say that there is a searching and a puzzlement which celebrates paradox and ambiguity while discouraging literalist fundamentalism and ambivalence. I want to repeat that. It's really, for me at least, important. This is a searching and a puzzlement. That is to say that I try to live in relationship with God is to say that you engage a constant, relentless, exhausting, sometimes enhancing, searching and puzzlement, which celebrates paradox and ambiguity, but doesn't let ambiguity devolve into ambivalence, which would freeze you, which would prevent you from understanding that yours are the only hands and feet that God has in the world, or from engaging a literalist fundamentalism that is mind-closing, not mind-opening. A searching and puzzlement, which I think is at the very heart of serious Jewish endeavor. There's, of course, a lot of other endeavor, Jewish endeavor. But serious Jewish endeavor demands searching and puzzlement, paradox and ambiguity. That searching is also as personal as an individual's synapses. And of course, no two individual synapses are exactly the same. Read Eric Kandel. And as communal as George Steiner's Share Train Memory. Drop everything and read his book, Real Presences, even this lecture. That is, if you now walk out or download it on your Kindle, Zebeseda. Share Train Memory, George Steiner says, is the key to viable Jewish identity because it provides protection, a deterrent to the detergent tide, his words, not mine, of social conformity and political oppression. So this Beit Midrash, the learning of Torah, the engagement of halakha as a communal discipline, forget its obsessive compulsive rigidities for a moment, as a communal discipline, is designed to create a human being, a Jew, who is resistant to the detergent tides of social conformity and political oppression. Look at the sheets in front of you, please, and this story of the Kotzka. I'm going to read the Hebrew and translate it, although it's translated on top, not as well as I'll do it. The Kotzka Rebbe was a Peterburgian spiritual virtuoso, which meant that he looked at the same things that we do, but he saw them differently, to a different depth. It's not that spiritual virtuosi see things you don't see. Right? How many other people saw that bush burning and not being consumed before Moshe Rabbeinu actually paid attention, and so it addressed them on a different level? The Kotzke Rebbe was apparently a spiritual virtuoso. He was also a manic depressive, as are many spiritual virtuosi, who suffered terribly from the depressive side of that modality and spent the last many years of his life in not very splendid isolation, living alone in a small room overlooking the main street of Kotz. And one day a chassid came and broke into that not splendid isolation. Chassid echad hashiach lifnei Rebbe mikotz ketzaro sheish lo hirurim rabim. He had disturbing thoughts. Dahainu shal Rabbi Mendel knew. What are they, he said. Choshesh ani levatei tam vaili, al kochi anani maher bahem, afilu b'geinom lo tiyeh li kapara, says this chosid. I'm afraid to express them. They come to me against my will. I mean, this is the beginning of the 19th century, but I know there's a sub and unconscious. By the way, I think the Tanakh knew there was a sub and unconscious as well. These thoughts come to me against my will, even in hell, which I think doesn't exist, but we'll let that slide. There won't be redemption. There won't be forgiveness. The Kotzker was known to be impatient. Umahem, he said, nu, what are they? Oili Rebbe, shekach halali. Meharera ni li'itim shemachas v'sholom, leiz din v'leiz dayan, ein din v'ein dayan. Oi Rebbe, sometimes I think there's neither judge nor justice in the world. I mean, who hasn't had that thought? Otherwise, why would you sit in a Bes Midrash if you didn't have that thought? What's this about? Let's put it in simpler language. Who are you accountable to? And what if there is no sense to this? Those of you who have been in therapy, my wife is a therapist, this is known as the breakthrough moment, right? You went through all of that transference and counter-transference. And you learned to trust the person and you learned to trust yourself and you finally got it out. This chassid finally gets it out. He thinks there's no meaning to existence. The Kotzke Rebbe says, Umach patlecha. What do you care? Kleine yid, small, insignificant Jew, so there's no judge or justice in the world. That's what's bothering you? The stock market is down 6% this month. The Blue Jays are losing in the playoffs. And you're worried that there's no judge or justice in the world? Rebbe kara chassid banacha kasha milev shavru mashayach machpatlim chalila indin vein dayan matachlit babriya. How do you say this? The chassid cries out with a broken heart. Remember the Kotzke Rebbe famously said, "Ein davar shalem yoter milev shavu v'zoik min admama." Nothing is more whole than a broken heart. Those of you that have had your hearts broken by falling out of love know when it's put back together, it is more whole, and cries out louder than silence. But here's better resonance for that notion of the Kotzker. Josh Feigelson, Rabbi Joshua Feigelson. teaches in the name of Parker Palmer. Drop everything and read To Know As You Are Known by Parker Palmer, the world's greatest informal educator. Catholic priests become Quaker. It's always those halachic types that give it up and then see wider, that become the deepest spiritual, that's an overgeneralization, sources of insight. Says Parker Palmer, the task of having a broken heart is to have the heart be so supple that it breaks open and not apart. The task is to have a heart so supple that it is heartbroken by tragedy, but it breaks open to be more embracing. It doesn't break apart. And silence, of course, we know speaks louder. Kol Dmama Daka, the thin voice of silence that addressed Eliyahu HaNavi, the silence on Sinai. Rebbe Karach Chassid Banachak Hashem Yilev Shavu. How do you tell me, Machpatli, what difference does it make to me? Chalila Ein Din Vein Dayan Matachlik Babriyah. If there's no ultimate judge or justice, what's the purpose of creation? Umachpatli Chashain Tachlit, says the Kotzkoi. So there's no purpose, no. Rebbe Akeitzadim Chas Vashalom Ein Tachlit Matam B'divrei Torah. If there's no meaning to creation, what's the meaning at all? What am I doing? Drank a cup learning Tosfos. Umachpatli Chashain Tamla Torah, says the Kotzkoi Rebbe. Rebbe mein tam la Torah in tam la chayim, v'zeh chpat limod. Says this chosu, but he really means it. He doesn't say it because it's kind of in vogue, you know. If there's no meaning to Torah, he says there's no meaning to life. And he really means that. I mean, that's to aspire in your learning. I don't know how many people ever get there. If you get there even one day and have a taste of that, I think it's enhancing for the rest of your life. I don't know if I've ever been there. Amar Rebbe Mendel. אם באמת אכפת לך כל כך הינך יהודי כשר ויהודי כשר מוטל עלה הרהל, says the Kotzke Rebbe, if that's really what bothers you, you're not just saying it because you're bored, because ennui is the condition of modernity, and of course every generation is modern to itself. You really mean that. This is about the meaning of life you are, this is untranslatable. Du bist a kusher yid, you are a fit and an appropriate Jew. That's a weak translation of a kushariyid. I don't know how to translate that. And for fit and appropriate Jews, it is permitted to have disturbing thoughts. If I had to put a mantra on the wall of a Bes Midrash, that's what I would put up. It is appropriate for Jews that care deeply to have disturbing thoughts. What I learned from this is that comfort is not a Jewish value, meaning and justice are. I mean, you're all smart enough to know nobody can make a claim that broad. You could bring me a few psukim from Tehillim or more than a few psukim from Tehillim and from this and from that to tell me that comfort is a Jewish value. Give it up. The foundation and ultimately most productive resonance of Jewish identity is meaning and justice, not comfort, which is, by the way, why American Jewry is in deep trouble. You don't need me to tell you that. Because there an entire culture sees comfort as its ultimate desideratum rather than meaning and justice. And so being a Jew in a serious way in North America is countercultural. That's the most important contribution of this Bes Midrash, is to make you counterculturalists. But if you need evidence for that, here's the best that I would offer you. So for most of my life, it's not true anymore. I've gotten old enough. For much of my life, I didn't daven regularly, which is the understatement of this in every conversation. And then when I started davening, I noticed that the first biblical passage in Shacharis of any real length, other than those one-liners, is the story of the Akedah. Really? That's how the Jews are supposed to start the morning? Not paean of praise to God, not something about creation, not something about wholeness. It's raining, it's good, you love your... Something? No. You bring the most inscrutable moral dilemma that any religious tradition could contend with, and you wake up the Jews with that. You tell a father to murder his son. And yeah, that's supposed to be virtuous. And then he's ready to do it. He picks up the knife to do it. Lishchot et beno. Let's be clear about this. He completely, it's because he was a man. No woman would have done, well, fewer women would have done that. He needs to, this is men. They act in principle, and to prove that he's really devoted to God, he's ready to commit murder. God says, okay, let me teach you that you shouldn't be such a man. There's a very strong gender bias in this story. So Avram Yehoshua Heschel, Zichrono Livracha, teaches this story. For this alone, it's good that Heschel taught. So he says there's an 8-year-old kid, Shmulek, learning in the cheder somewhere in the bowels of winterized Poland. And they're learning the Akedah, and Shmuel, sitting in the back row of the cheder, starts crying. And the Rebbe says, "Nu Shmuel, what is? What's going on?" And Shmuel says, "Oy, Rebbe," says, "Avram Avinu is going to kill Yitzchak." So the Rebbe says, "Shmuel, calm down. First of all, you're 8 years old and you've got a good Jewish education, and this is the third time we're learning this, so you know that that's not what happens." Okay, so he calms down, and you know Mishnah by heart, but that's another story. So he goes on, he tries to teach, and Shmuel starts crying again. So the Malamed stops, he says, "Nu Shmuel, what is?" So Shmuel says, "Rebbe, an articulate 8-year-old kid, says, Rebbe, this is unbearable. Avram Avinu is going to kill his son." The Malamed gets a little impatient and he says, "Listen, Shmuel, I already told you once, it's Zman Bitul Limud Torah, you're taking time away from our learning Torah. It'll be okay, you know how the story ends." He goes on to teach once more, Shmuel cries, and now the Malamed is impatient, he says, "Shmuel, that's enough. I've told you that in the end, an angel comes and prevents Avram from killing Yitzchak." Shmuel says, "Rebbe, what if this time the angel comes too late?" Says Avram Yehoshua Heschel, in the middle of the Vietnam War, "If you have the faith of Avram Avinu, you have that immediacy of relationship with ultimacy, some of you call it God, then you can count on the angel coming on time and staying your hand. But if you're any lesser person, I don't know you well enough, I'll take a chance," which is everybody sitting in this Beis Midrash, "never put the blade to the throat of an innocent person. For you, the angel might not come in time, and you will become a heinous criminal beyond redemption." Comfort is not a Jewish value. That's what the Jews want you to do first thing in the morning. By the way, then you're supposed to say, Baruch Shema, Olam, get through all of that. Shmon Esrei, you just kind of forget that. Inscrutable moral dilemma. But that was the wake-up call. To wield power, the power of the knife, the power of sovereign political control, is to embrace the discomfort of controlling the destiny of the other. As Richard Rubinstein taught us in the famous essay, now too little read, called God After Auschwitz, the real force of historical control is to impose your understanding of history on the other. Real control of the other is to make them read history according to your myth. By the way, by myth, of course, we don't mean something untrue. We mean the stories that you tell about yourself that are the most revealing of who you really are. Hence, of course, the Tanakh is Jewish myth. Of course those stories aren't true. The Rambam knew they weren't literally true. It's a barul. What it is though, a recollection of the most important stories the Jews would tell about themselves to let you know what Jewish civilization is about. Real control is imposing that myth. Immanuel Levinas. Drop everything. Kill yourselves to read inscrutably difficult French and English. I don't know the French, but the guy who lives two doors away, Daniel Epstein, Taka was a Talmid Muvhak of Levinas, so I say to him, "Rav Epstein, this is really unbelievable. You have such an advantage. I can only read in the translation. I can't understand a single sentence." He says, "You have it easier than I do." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "The translator at least try to clean it up a little bit and make it coherent." Teaches Levinas. The reason that you have halacha, with all of its arbitrary restrictions, what you can't eat and who you can't sleep with and what you can't touch and where you can't go and what you can wear and what days you need to rest. So of course it's arbitrary. You actually have trust in a God that cares if Levi Lauer turns the lights on Shabbos when there's Rwanda in the world? You actually have trust in ultimacy that has a sense of priority that would take Levi Lauer's not having Hadassi Meshulashim on his lulav when there's Syria in the world? No, says Levinas. The halacha is, of course, arbitrary because it comes not to be an end but to teach you restraint. If you can restrain yourselves in those little ways, don't eat that, don't sleep with that one, don't go there, don't go on the Temple Mount, don't eat those things, don't wear those clothes, you will, he says, maybe, just maybe, condition yourself so that when you have power over the life of the other to do harm, you will have conditioned yourself to restraint. and back off. Levinas tells us something else. It's so daunting, I hate to say it. I mean that. It's a little manipulative, but it's true. I mean, I teach this not infrequently, but it's so. Said Immanuel Levinas, never look into the eyes of another person for whom you're not prepared to take total responsibility. That will explain, by the way, those of you from the Upper West Side, why you look down on the floor of the 1 and 9, because what if one of those crazed, schizophrenic marimba players walks by you and you're looking him in the eyes? Now what? So I once said this in a lecture, so I was looking at somebody deliberately when I did it, and she came up during the break and she said, "Levy, thank you very much for looking at me. I don't have tuition for the second semester. Help me." That's fair. That's fair. Says Levinas, "You were created to live in a relationship. You only exist as you exist in relationship with the other." Let's give that Jewish frame. O chavruta, o mituta. There is either interdependence or there is stagnation or death. This also makes you countercultural in North America, and it's not very splendid ethic of rugged individualism. Rugged individualism. What's rugged about that? It's pathetically narcissistic, self-serving, and counterproductive. Of course it's difficult to relive in relationship. My wife will tell you about that. No, I mean, we're married 47 years, so I can say that now. But there have been some days. Levinas also said this, God is, thereby making, you don't know Yiddish, thereby rendering the Rambam speechless. God is, says Levinas, paying the worker the amount that he deserves on the day that he did his labor, thereby combining Sefer Vayikra and the Marxist Manifesto. Says Levinas, no fool, I know what you're thinking, it's that simple? That's not overly simplistic. He says, you've got something better to give me you're going to call God? I gave you a page here to read that says it better than I do. You hear that? If these are the only hands and feet that God has in the world, you're paying the worker the amount that he deserves on the day that he did his work is godlike. It's a recognition of ultimacy in the world. You got something better than that? Do you know how much you have to shuckle to do better than that? The engagement of discomfort is the discomfort of a doctrine of collective responsibility. This is why it's easier. This is not fair to many serious Christians, but I'll say it anyhow. And people here that know Christianity better than I do, so argue afterwards. This is why it's easier to be a Christian than a Jew in many ways, and why Christianity is so much more immediately appealing. To me too, on this level. There's no doctrine of individual salvation for the Jews. It's all collective. Klal Yisrael, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zevazek, Knesset Yisrael, 600,000 Jews, a wildly exaggerated number in the Tanakh, stood at Sinai. All of them together. What? I'm the most decent person I know. I do all those things that Mish gives me credit for. By the way, it's not me. It's the staff. They get the credit. It's a shame they're not here. They're doing the work. I just had a little imagination. A little imagination. What, I'm this wonderful person and my neighbor next door is a big shtunk. He cheats, he lies, he screams at his wife, he abuses his children, he kicks the cat. And I'm not going to get Olam Haba, which doesn't exist because of his bad behavior? What? Here's paradox and ambiguity in the Tanakh. It's too bad I didn't understand this longer ago. I would have been a much better person. Smarter one anyhow. Listen to this. On the one hand, it's all about collective identity. On the other hand, the moments of most important revelation come when the Jews are standing completely alone. Vayivatel Yaakov Levado, and Jacob is completely alone. He wrestled with ultimacy, and his name was changed to Yisrael. Alone. Moshe Rabbeinu, twice on top of Mount Sinai, fabulous myth. Alone. Completely alone. Eliyahu Navi, who recapitulates the Sinai story in Malachim Aleph Yud Tet. Vayivater ani levadi, says Eliyahu HaNavi, twice in 8 psukim, and I'm completely left alone. Then revelation comes to you. What? On the one hand, it's all about collective, and on the other hand, that's right. There's paradox and ambiguity for you. How do you carve out enough alone so that you have those moments of true revelatory understanding and at the same time adhere to the discipline of communal responsibility. The embrace of discomfort is also the embrace of uncertainty. To be a Jew is to be radically uncertain in a serious way. Look at the pages I gave you, please. Look at, I hope they put it in order. If they didn't, it's my fault. I brought it the last second. Yeah, look at the back of the first, the back of the first page. This is from Masechet Yevamot in the Bavli Mem Tet Aleph. You see those, they're a little vague, about six lines from the bottom. Do you see those brackets in the text in the Gemara? See that? Got it? V'arere et Hashem k'detanya kol ha-nevi'im nistaklu ba'asfaklar shena mi'ra mosh rabbeinu nistakel ba'asfaklar mi'ra. He said that I might see God. See God? You need the Rambam to tell you you can't see God? As it was taught, all of the prophets looked into this prism, this wondrous prism. Aspaklaria, Sheina Mira, but it didn't give off any reflection for them. Moshe Rabbeinu nistakel baspaklaria hameira. Moshe Rabbeinu looked into it and it reflected for him, says Rashi. Look on the right hand side. See those brackets? Nistaklu baspaklaria Shein Mira. The other prophets looked into it and it didn't reflect. Uchsvurim lerot v'lo ra'u, and they were certain they would see. Prophets, they think they know truth. They looked into it and they were certain that they'd seen. Umoshe nistakel baspaklaria hameira, but Moshe looked into it and for him it reflected viyada shelo ra'u b'fanav, and he knew he hadn't seen absolute truth at all. You get that? Umoshe anav haya mikol adam. His humility came by understanding that by knowing more he knew less. He understood that no one is granted absolute certainty. And the claims to it are beyond the pale of Jewish possibility. You have it right in the Torah. Ki lo yir'ani hadam v'chai, Moshe Rabbeinu. It's really sad. It's like straight from the Greeks. He breaks the tablets. The Kodesh Baruch Hu, by the way, there's chutzpah. You take the most important thing ever given a human being and you shatter it and you say to God, give me another set. So the Kodesh Baruch Hu says, okay, but get this right. I read Derrida. When I reconstruct it, it's going to be slightly different. And he gets a slightly different version. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, you know what? I slept. I'm a community organizer for the Jewish people. None of you should try to do that. I'm not serious, of course. I'm a community organizer for the Jewish people. I lead them through this desert. It's unbearable. They're impossible. They're divided into tribes as we are divided in this society, which could rend us asunder. This is a Middle Eastern people in the Middle East given to tribalism. Read Moshe Albertar's article about this. I'm dealing with a motley bunch. They have weird habits and they call themselves weird names and they don't like to be disciplined and they're cantankerous. I've done all this. Once I asked you to give me your name so that I would be able to tell them in whose name we do this, you show me, you give me nothing. Riddle, yeah, sure, yeah, what's that? All aspirants. I can't even get it out. I can barely articulate it. Now, finally, I want to hear it. Toch and tish, pardon the expression, on Har Sinai. Put my rear end on the table and say, and you just give me a name. The Kodesh Baruch Hu says, you know what? You're a decent guy. You've given to the UJA. You slept with the Jewish people. Here it is. I couldn't resist that. Here it is. And he gives him his name. Moshe's overwhelmed. He says, okay, now let me see your face. He knows that God doesn't have a face. What he means is, let me know that there is certainty in the world about one thing. Let me know there is really ultimacy in the world. I'm leading this people on the foundation of a commitment to ultimacy, by the way, and social revolution. Let me know that there is such a foundation of truth. God shows him his backside, puts his hand over him, hanging or protected, depends how you read that, benikrat hatzul, and says to him, ki lo yira'ani hadam v'chai, for no one shall see me and live, says George Steiner, one of the smartest people that ever lived. Still living with a horrendous politics, but that's an aside. Says George Steiner, there's one word in this posuk that's superfluous. Why didn't he just say, nobody can see me? We get it clear. We read the Rambam. We got it. What do you mean, v'chai? And live, says Steiner. There's only one moment that you really know something of a certainty. Absolutely, finally, and inalterably. And that's the moment of death. The tragedy of death is not that the body stops functioning, although hopefully that happens later rather than sooner. The tragedy of death is now you know it finally and absolutely, and you can't teach it. And that's Jewish tragedy. The inability to articulate and to teach is the worst of Jewish curses. That's why laryngitis is in some way the most problematic Jewish disorder. Ki lo yirani adam v'chai means in the most important level, you will never know it absolutely. Show restraint. Show restraint. Understand that the needs of the other are part of your own identity. Understand that your imposition of your myth on their existence comes at high price. Show restraint. You can't be certain. What? You're asking me to sit in the Beis Midrash 10 hours a day, grind through these baffling texts, give up the job that I could have had at Wall Street, or in the case of Atsum, better yet, take salaries that are not salaries. I mean, the staff will tell you this. Because the director was able in some way to say, listen, my friend, I'm going to say this to you. I don't even know who I'm talking to. It's the most dangerous and outrageous thing. I don't know a single thing, but unless there's been a radical departure of who's accepted in this program, all of you, unless they did a bad job at admission, are stable enough emotionally, able enough intellectually, good enough looking, and more important, able to make the world work for you, which is an unteachable skill. People that suffer in this world are people that didn't know how to make connections. You all have the capacity to give of yourselves and live minimally materially for 3 to 5 years and do good in the world. That's what you say to people who you recruit for staff for Atsum. They say, Levy, okay, fine. What's the salary? They gasp. They say, no. You say, listen, Sprinzel, there's nobody really that name on the staff at Atsum. Although I would hire anybody that came to me with the name Sprinzel, I would hire. Just to have a staff person, I could say, Sprinzel, was machst da jiddische Mädel? It would give me such nachas, I would hire just for a name. You say, Sprinzel, listen, you're extraordinarily good looking. You know how to make connections. You have more than enough clothes, and in Israel, nobody cares what shmatas you're wearing. Somehow you'll always have enough food to eat, probably too much, so you'll have to do some weird liquid diet. And you'll have some kind of roof of your head, even if it's unbearable nachlaot, you'll be okay. Give me 3 to 5 years and end sex trafficking in the state of Israel. She looks at you and she's thinking, and then you say, and I'll tell you one other thing. This is really self-serving. I don't want this repeated, please. And there's one other thing. You'll be making infinitely more than the director. Hear that clearly. That is, you give to, and in larger measure, and that enables you to put your hand in somebody else's pocket, so to speak. And then you get 3 to 5 years of brilliant, devoted, burnt out, difficult struggle that was done much better than it. And you let people work, by the way. The next job you take, if it's in this area, if it's something else, I don't know what to tell you. But if it's in this area, make your own mistakes. Take a job where they'll let you make your own mistakes, not the boss's. Yours will be no worse and come with better passion. So you hire people to make their mistakes, not yours. And then when they make them, you pick up the phone and they say, Levy, we're in deep trouble. You say, okay, let's fix it. You never recriminate. My father, Alav HaShalom, who was not philosophically bent, to put it mildly, taught me two important things philosophically. Levy once said to me in a row, know this, when they say the Jews are the smartest people in the world, they don't mean it as a compliment to us. They mean it as an insult to the rest of humankind. And the second thing that he said was, Levy, if you ever need to scream at anyone, scream at somebody that has more power than you, not less. So it's good to remember. I'm going to tell you one more story in the most personal way about ambiguity. So at the not tender age of 34, I went to the Israeli army. I mean, it was the first time they called me up. And I went to what turned into a combat artillery unit, and twice in the war in Lebanon, which I'm not happy about, to put it mildly. Completely unnecessary, wasted 20 years. Not talk about the destruction. But at any rate, the third day of basic training, the first 2 days, they teach you guys Shlab Betnikim. That's a euphemism for I can't use the language in the Beis Midrash, for older folks. They, for 2 days, 48 hours, they teach you nothing but how to hold that rifle without killing the guy standing next to you, which is important because you could do it easily. It's unbelievable how much damage you can do with that thing. And then they take you out to a firing range and they put an outline of a human figure at 150 meters and they give you 10 bullets and you shoot. Good. I shot my 10 bullets by, I don't believe in Nes Min HaShemayim, but this was one. By what could only be described as divine intervention, 9 of those bullets actually hit the target. By the way, every time after that, not only did I not hit the target, I didn't hit the mountain behind the target, and the bullets are in Bat Yam or Cholon or Chveswer, somewhere on the coast. So that night there was a conversation, and they got 35 of us together. By the way, I don't know if you know this, there were 12 of us who were all Jewish educators in one tent. This was like Camp Ramah with guns. And what was better yet was that there were a variety, to put it mildly, of theological understandings of the Jewish tradition, so that you could actually cause a guy not to sleep at night by saying, Yehuda, who do you think wrote Sefer Vayikra? And he literally woke up and didn't sleep for the next 2 weeks because he was so troubled that he had an apikoros like that sleeping with him in the tent. At any rate, they put us all around and they go around and they say to you, okay, well, how do you feel about this? So, some guy said, I look good in green, it gives me Zionist power, I can defend my people. I'm really happy. I was always very skinny and grew up with a horrible body image and was always imagined that that bully would kick the sand in my eyes at the beach. You don't know those advertisements. There's all of that stuff. So, and there a guy said, I really feel defending the Jewish people. This is the realization that came to me. I said, listen, I'm really troubled. I'm an educator, and I know how difficult it is to refine morally, intellectually a human being, and here in 1 second you can rend a human being asunder. You have to put in all of that effort for years to make this much of a difference. And in 1 second, good, 20 minutes later there's a tap on my shoulder. There stands a guy with 2 stripes up here, and he's over 20, which means this is a serious person when you're in basic training in the Israeli army. I don't even know whether he was shaving or not, but he was over 20 and had 2 stripes. He says to me, Liol, they called me by the wrong name in the Israeli army for 11 years. Instead of calling me Levi Laol, they called me Liol Levi. I say to the sergeant, some 19-year-old fisher from somewhere else, I say to the guy, no, Levi's a shem aprati. He says, lo nachon, Levi's a shem mishpacha. Okay, and if you didn't answer to what they called, you didn't get out for Shabbos. So I was for 11 years Liol Levi, no problem. So there's a tap on my shoulder, and this guy says, Liol Bohena. I thought, oh my God, you know, somebody died at home, my wife, her grandfather was ill. I said, what is this? He says, Lech l'sham v'l taberi mishu. I go in, there's a guy sitting with 3 things up there, I figure. I said, what is it? I said, if you don't mind me asking, who are you? He says, I'm the unit psychiatrist. I say, I thought, what could this possibly be? He says, Tagid li Liol ma malta lahem. You know, what'd you tell them? So I thought, he said, Liol, take your left-wing sympathies and keep them to yourself. You're, of course, right. I share them. I'm from Argentina. All those psychiatrists escaped the junta. They all came to Israel to drop their left-wing, you know, part of it, to drop their left-wing sensibilities on us and to escape getting dropped in the ocean and murdered with their relatives. He says, of course you're right. You don't say that. You say you feel proud to be a Zionist. Now get out of here. I don't have time to waste that. But from this I learned something. The relative weight of strength that is destructive and that which is constructive in the world is an imbalance. And so is truth and falsehood. Izzy Stone, I.F. Stone, the legendary journalist philosopher, once said that for every lie that McNamara took 5 seconds to make up during the Vietnam War and then got paid $25,000 a lecture to confess, it took Izzy Stone 8 hours a day of research, 5 days a week for 2 months in the Library of Congress to disprove. And from that he learned something about the relative weight of truth and falsehood in the world. But yours are the only feet and hands that God has in the world. And your responsibility is to ask how to address that imbalance and how to swing things the other way. So what does collective responsibility tell us about, let's call her Z for the purpose of this discussion. We work on trafficking and prostitution. We're trying to pass Nordic law legislation in the Knesset that will decriminalize the provider and criminalize the purchaser of sexual services. About 10 years ago, Z escaped her pimp, amazingly, with his name and identity card, and came to the shelter in Tel Aviv, and they called us because we provide the legal and legislative resources for these situations. And Z tells us, in Russian and Uzbeki, that she had been brutalized as a sex slave for about 16 months, had been raped as many as 20 times a day. Hear this carefully, please. Men don't have sex with prostitutes. They rape sex slaves. And don't give me pretty women. There's one in 1,000 like that, I'll give you that. But don't give me pretty women. And I'll tell you something else. And I really feel adamant about this. And if it makes you nervous, suffer. Of course it's none of you. And it's none of your brothers or uncles or fathers or grandfathers or friends. It's just everybody else's brothers, uncles, fiancés, boyfriends. 3,000, 30,000 times a month in the state of Israel, it's somebody else, but never you. When she got to the shelter, she weighed 32 kilo and was dying of multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis and had been raped 12 times in the preceding 24 hours. 32 kilo. Because men don't have sex with prostitutes. They have power over the body of women. It's not about sex. It's about power. Even for Lamar Odom, for those of you following that sick story. So we took her testimony, and it was clear that she was dying, and we asked her to sign on 400 different forms, a release telling us that we could do with it whatever we wanted with her story, as long as her mother was the ultimate beneficiary. We paid to send her back to Uzbekistan a week later. She died in her mother's arms 48 hours after going home. It's a very long story. We won a groundbreaking case first in the Supreme Court. It was a long story how it happened. But anyhow, we got 500,000 shekels for her from the State of Israel, which the attorneys that we work with, pro bono, Kabiri Nevokedar, saintly people. By the way, there are no saints. A saint is somebody you don't know enough about, so you think they're a tzaddik, but these are the closest to it. They took, you're not allowed to take that kind of money, but what are you going to take, a check to rural Uzbekistan? Yeah, yeah, the bank's going to just hand this lady the money. So they packed suitcases with $100 bills, and we're lucky it wasn't open to customs. Gave her mother the money. So now I want to just put this right out here in the Beis Midrash. What's your collective responsibility to Z? What does it mean to live in a society that allows hundreds of brothels to flourish and thousands of women to be raped in the society that calls itself the state that would wrestle with God, or even Boston, or Los Angeles, or New York, or Cleveland, if anyone's unfortunate enough to live there? Peter Singer, who teaches at Princeton, you likely know that, tells us that if he were to lecture and bring some kid from the slums of Mumbai who was 24 hours away from death, standing at the side and said, Chaverim, I need $10,000 to save this kid, you'd probably give it. Peter Singer says, do I have to put this kid in the room? I'm trying to develop a technology. I'm being serious. If any of you know about this, I'd be happy to talk with you. I need a hologram of that kid. I can't afford to put the kid in the room. I need a hologram so that you can visualize this. And then I can say to you, see that kid? Your responsibility to look into the eyes of the other is to see that that kid doesn't die. Says Peter Singer, if you don't do that, any other use of your superfluous resources is murderous. I'm not being self-righteous. I have more shirts than you do and too many pairs of pants. And this is confession. So make chavrutot for tzedakah, chaverim. Push each other. I'll stop buying pants. This is an honest promise. If somebody here tells me what they'll do with the equivalent amount of money or what they'll stop buying, I'm on. You hear me? I once said this to a group of very wealthy people from Riverdale. Some guy says, Levy, I'm really moved. I'll give up wine. I'm such a schnook. I grew up in a lower middle class family in Cleveland. I'd say, something tells me I'm getting the worst of the deal. He says, Levy, you don't know anything about wine. You hear that? Push each other. It's hard to do this alone. You don't want to be the only one that's wearing ragged clothes, as if you wear ragged clothes. You don't want to be the only one that stopped going to restaurants because you gave that $1,000 a year to some kid, to the hologram of some kid from India. You got something better to do with $1,000? Paul Farmer, drop everything and read Tracy Kidder's Mountains Beyond Mountains, everything. Is anybody here not ready yet? I'm skip school tomorrow. I'll pay, download it on your Kindle and read it, and then call me in the middle of the night, because you know, you won't have good sleeping for weeks. Not because it's not enhancing, because it's so enhancing that when I had this experience, I shouldn't have read it. I was in Los Angeles, read it jet lag, and I looked in the mirror the next morning, and I look like shit. Not because of the jet lag. It's because Paul Farmer says to us, listen, your task in life is to have the courage to fail. Your task in life is to take on the concerns of justice so vast that you can't possibly fulfill them. But in failing, you will make the world a better place. But you need courage to fail. Because failure is something that we fear deeply. So we don't embrace life's challenges deeply enough, considerably enough. Learn the courage to fail, says Paul Farmer. This is why we're hesitant to move toward where it belongs, to the streets. Here's why. Because the best lecture and the best drasha and the best intellectual insight is astoundingly easier than improving one single life at serious risk. I know that. When we help families who were on the wrong bus at the wrong time in the Yiddish Medina and got blown up, oh, and we gave them tuition scholarships and we paid for other elective plastic surgeries. You think you ever heal that? Forget the PTSD. It's not just that. Their faith in the human condition has been gone. Gone. Eviscerated. Some of them did, some of them before didn't believe in God, ultimacy. Now they can't believe in humankind where you left. It's much more difficult to go to the streets than to go to the Beis Midrash. That's why the Beis Midrash is a refuge. You shouldn't be allowed to sit here too much. I fight with Mish about this all the time. They do 3 hours of week volunteer work a week, no big deal. I mean, of course it's wonderful and you should do it. But you're going to be the only feet that God has hands in the world, and you're going to do Din V'cheshbon every Yom Kippur, and the Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to say to you, Shmerel, how much volunteer work did you do? Forget the volunteer. How much did you do last year, paid or otherwise, to make the world a better place? He said, listen, I was busy learning, but I gave 3 hours a week. What do you think the Kodesh Baruch Hu is going to say? How many hours did you watch baseball games this summer? It's embarrassing. It's like Ambien for me. You need to learn and do at the same time. Because doing is learning, and the Jewish world doesn't get that enough yet. Your most precious asset is your time, and you have too little of it. How should you use it? I'm going to conclude by reading this, and then if you have questions, but there's one more text I'd like to learn. If you have patience for that, you'll tell me. Milan Kundera, on page 11 of one of the greatest novels ever written, The Unbearable Lightness of Being, that you should drop everything and read, and see the movie. It's one of the few times where the movie is almost as good as the book. And the eroticism is brilliant. It actually stayed away from the pornographic and stayed just on the erotic. Milan Kundera writes this. The weight of unbearable responsibility lies heavy on every move we make. But is heaviness truly deplorable and lightness splendid? The heaviest of burdens crushes us. We sink beneath it. It pins us to the ground. The heaviest of burdens is therefore simultaneously an image of life's most intense fulfillment. The heavier the burden, the closer our lives come to the earth, the more real and truthful they become. Conversely, the absolute absence of a burden causes man to be lighter than air, to soar into the heights, take leave of the earth and his earthly being, and become only half real, his movements now as free as they are insignificant. What then shall we choose? Weight or lightness? What then shall we choose? Weight or lightness? Thanks. I'd be happy to answer or hear better understandings or teach one more text. No. Focused only on things in Israel. Our own backyard is so dirty until we clean that up. Don't have time to don't have time, resources, or energy to concentrate on the whole world. I need to clean up my own backyard. But there's good news. When we started with this 10 years ago, there were 3,200 women a year trafficked over the Egyptian border. In unbearable conditions. There's no way to describe this. I'll give you a feeling of this. I'll ruin your day. We know of two instances in which those women flown from the former Soviet Union to Cairo, brought through easily bribed passport lines in Cairo, turned over to Egyptian Bedouin, who then raped them systematically, every one of them, and brought them through the Sinai Peninsula, brought them to 500 meters from the Israeli border, tied them around the neck in groups of 8 to 10, forced them over the Israeli border, where they were picked up by Egyptian Bedouin, by Israeli Bedouin, who then took them, stripped them naked, sold them on the block in Be'er Sheva, and they lot with the full knowledge of the army and the police. Don't misunderstand this. With the full knowledge of Tzahal and Mishteret Yisrael, Greda. We know of two instances when the women didn't run fast enough or couldn't. So they cut off their heads and put them on spikes as warnings to the women coming down the Wadi. In your state? No, so we have to clean up our own backyard. Here's the good news. We begged the former prime minister and the current, I'll let it go at that, to put up a fence there. So he told us, you're right, we should put up a fence, we can't afford it. I told him I'd do the fundraising. Do you know what a fundraiser this would have been? I could have gotten every Jew in San Francisco and New York to wear a shirt saying, I'm volunteering against human trafficking and stand on the border. Would have been a fabulous fundraiser. But they wouldn't do it. Of course, now they did it, and now there's no more trafficking over that border. They didn't do it because of trafficking. They don't care that much about those women. They did it because it's a security risk. So now the only way to get through, almost the only way to get through, Baruch Hashem, we have very bad neighbors on the Jordanian and northern border, so there it's pretty much protected. The only way to get them through is by the sea, very complicated, in contravention of international law. The Israeli Navy stops everything that moves out there, fortunately. So the only way to get them through is through the airport. So you bring them in, having bought the identity of Jewish women from the former Soviet Union that didn't want to make Aliyah, and you stick that picture on that identity, and you bring them in. And they step foot on Israeli soil and claim law of return. Trafficked women. You'll say to me, Levy, wait a minute. You don't have to be the Gadol HaDor to figure out that if you put a policeman and a representative there, an interior minister, and you stopped every woman between the ages of 18 and 35, and you said, excuse me, who are you really? You'll find this on 10 seconds. My foreign minister thinks that that's prejudicial against Ukrainian and Russian tourists. So he dropped the visa requirement. Is he on the take from the criminal underground that makes $1 billion a year in trafficking and in prostitution? Maybe. I don't know. I don't know to say yes. I don't know to say no. No, somebody else needs... It's gratuitous for me to say this. Somebody else needs to deal with Syria. We got to clean up our own backyard first. I'm struggling with that. Another question or two, and then I'll teach this last text. Yeah, please. Tell me your name and the odd chance that we have relatives in common. Say that again. Last name?
Emerson.
From?
Philadelphia. The point you made about people not having sex with prostitutes, but that the only appropriate language, it sounds like, is rape and slavery. That's the meaning I took. I guess the first question is that what you meant? But and moreover, do you think that all sex labor is slavery, necessarily?
Thanks. I'll be more nuanced. The most optimistic studies show that 10% of the women engaged in prostitution are doing it of their own free will. My wife had a client who raised 4 years' tuition by sleeping with men in Tokyo. Yes, there are some cases like that. To protect 90% of those other women, I have to let those 10% find another way to make a living, A. B, even those women, although they don't like to talk about it, and I don't like to say this because they got enough tsoros, are often between the ages of 4 and 14 victims of incest and rape. And their body image has been so severely compromised that they think that this is the only way they can use their body. Thirdly, not any man you know, but every other man, are men that have an urgent need, maybe hardwired, says my friend, the chairman of the neurology department at Harvard, maybe hardwired, but so what? The Torah doesn't believe in hardwiring. Too bad you're hardwired. Stop stealing. Too bad you're hardwired. Stop sleeping with your aunt. Men seem to be hardwired to need to have control over women's bodies. I can't allow that to persist for the sake of 10% at the most women who are doing this of their own free will. You know what? 90% of the people that come to four-way stops don't need a stop sign. They would stop. I can't take a chance on 10% going through and killing somebody. But more than that, I have to re-educate men that they cannot have that voracious need to dominate women's bodies. Some things cannot be for sale. I'll say it more strongly. If you allow that, the other abuses of women are small potatoes. You can raise the glass ceiling as high as you want if you allow that. Because that also comes with strip parties and the back rooms of the nightclubs in Tel Aviv and Ramat Gan. No. Not for my daughter, not for my granddaughter, not for you, and not for any other woman I know. Let him find another living. I'll help him find a job. Anybody else a question? Yeah.
I'd be interested in hearing, if you'd like to share, your evolution of how you've been dealing with the question of where are my responsibilities and where you currently are, or with that.
It's my parents' fault. I hope my parents will get nachas from this from their graves in Cleveland. Well, they won't get nachas because my father, the day I was ordained, came up and said, Mazel Tov, gave me a kiss and said, Nu, when are you getting your doctorate? I'm still not over that. That's what a father should do. So until I bring that degree and put it in a frame at its grave, they won't rest in peace there. Okay. I once applied to a PhD program. They asked me why I was doing it. I told them the truth. They said no. My mother was a first grade teacher in the single most social economically deprived African American school in Cleveland, Ohio for 27 years. She refused to accept that one of those kids should leave her class without a toothbrush, a shirt, a pair of pants, the ability to do math, read and write. My shirts and toothbrushes and everything else disappeared regularly from my drawers. She used to knock on people's houses where there were no parents, kids wearing sheets. At 79th and Woodland, you'd have to know Cleveland to appreciate this fully enough. My mother was about 4'11", 80 pounds. I said, Ma, your only advantage is they don't see you. If they saw you, you would have long ago been resting in Glenville Cemetery. But to be so small, they never looked at anyone that small. They start up there and look down. To find you, they have to look from the ground up. So my mama kind of taught me that. And my tata was a person who had no patience with authority and no truck with the brutal suppression of people in need. It was just kind of instinctive by them. So when I put together Atsuma, I asked myself, who are the most vulnerable populations that I know and what might we able to be to do for them? I don't know if it's the best choice. I don't know. I'm not sure. I'll say one more word about this. I had a cup of coffee. This is how life can be, coincidental. I had a cup of coffee with the wrong person. You should always try to do that. And at the time, we were working with foreign workers who were severely injured in the workplace and then deprived of medical care because they were dumped by their employers. They had no passports, no language, no health insurance. They'd show up at Adassa with a kidney about to go out, and Adassa said, we're not taking care of you. You have no insurance. So I had a bargain with the emergency room at Adassa, like buying tomatoes in Shuk Machane Yehuda, by the way, to their credit. You argue long enough, they take them in. It'll cost you $2,000 instead of $100,000 for a kidney, but okay. By the way, your job is to find $2,000. No, you're going to let that guy die? On my conscience? It was already more than I can bear. And then I had a cup of coffee with somebody from the hotline for migrant workers. She said, Levi Zakatana Lecha, this is too small for you. I said, what? She said, take on trafficking. I didn't even know there was such a thing. Trafficking where? So she told me. So you can't hear a thing like that and go home and say, Chaya, let's go out to dinner. So instead I said, Chaya, let's take some of our savings and put together something and let's see what we can do here. I said, no, really? So it's kind of quirky. I'll say one other thing to my wife's credit. When I started this, she said, I'm willing to do this, but you have to give me an end to this. So I gave her a very definite end, which were goals that in my life I never thought I would achieve, and I wanted to feel good about myself. I wanted to give away more money than I could possibly ever earn in a lifetime, and I wanted to do more good than I could do by myself. I said, Chai, if we do this, I'll stop. That was 9 years ago. Chai says, new lady. It's her fault. She married me. I didn't. She could have said no. Now, you hear that. Should I share this? Try to marry the right person or live in permanent relationship with. I try to be political. I don't know what they say. No, marry. Marry a person who is tolerant of your most egregious excesses if they're for the benefit of humankind. And has patience with you when you fail, because you have the courage to fail and you can't possibly do it well. And you have no idea how much sorrows I get daily from people who tell me we're not doing it well enough. What's worse is they're right. This woman hung herself a month ago in that brothel in Tel Aviv rather than be raped again. We, Atsum, I wasn't here. The staff, they get all the credit. Mamish. So they organized the whole thing, and yesterday we won a very, very important decision in the Tel Aviv district court that will, if the police enforce it, which they won't, we'll have to work on that next, will change the whole face of prostitution in Israel. So you do that, but you need somebody, I'm telling you, if it's not somebody that you live with permanently, have a chavil that you can pick up the phone to and say, what the hell am I going to do with this? This is unbearable. And they say, have courage, I'm with you. My wife says that her counseling skills are improved daily by talking to me. Do I have time to teach this one text or I should drop it? You can tell me. I'll drop it. Okay. If you want to hear it, come to the thing and I'll do it there. I'm sorry that I didn't get there. Thank you very, very much for having me. So,
thank you.